Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the African Knowledge Beyond the Book Club weekly podcast. We're back discussing Pawn Sovereignty by Ezra Aharon. And I'm your host, Charles, and I'm joined by my lovely wife, Jalavet, on the Wheels of Steel, keeping it real. Say hello to everyone, Jalavet.
Hello to everyone, Jalavet.
There you go. Spicing it up a little bit, you know.
The wheels of steel.
So steel and they're rolling.
Just,
you know.
Stuff like that. Anyway.
Yeah, we do. Tonight's featured discussion is inheriting enemies. And we're going to get into what Professor Aharon means by inheriting enemies. And we need to really look at how we need to really prioritize and change the way we relate to other nationalities.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to achieve power, because you and I have been talking about power relations, and Professor Aharon talks about power relations, but however you notice, we see a lot of the discourse in mainstream black media or even not so mainstream. They don't talk about power relations, how to get power, getting what you want, making sure you're not being taken advantage of. Everybody is just mainly talking about getting money, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Getting money, getting paid, and, you know, while you want to get paid, but you want to have power is more important than the money, because the power gives you to create the money.
Right.
And control the economy with the power. But without the power, you're merely just a beggar.
That's right.
Servant. And so Dr. and Professor Amos Wilson talked about all the time how we're just a nation of servants.
Right.
And all we do is figure out how to get paid higher for our servitude. That's pretty much all black folks want to do.
Right. Bartering our services.
Right.
And our consumer power, our consuming power.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to really shift away from that, that's going to take a radical change in thinking and, you know, a radical re-education. And
I don't know, you know, if I'm off the mark or what have you, or perhaps being, not off the mark, but being cynical, and you can let me know what you think, but you were saying just now, and we often say, almost to the point to where we sound like a broken record, we're always talking about the necessary shift in thinking. And it immediately put me in the mind of an article that, not an article, actually it was just a graphic that was posted about the company Pantene that created something called a co-wash. And that is something that was, you know, a term. It's short for a conditioning wash, and it has to do with natural hair care. And it's something that for that company to know about that, they would either have to be, you know, checking out the black hair care forums and that kind of thing, or have someone, you know, basically doing it for them or what have you. But That is something that is very, very particular. It's one of those, you know, kind of, not a colloquialism, but just it's a term or turn of phrase that you would have to kind of be in that subculture of natural hair care people to know what that is. And they have created this product and put it on the front label, co-wash, right? And so the person who posted this particular graphic was trying to make the point that obviously, you see, we're constantly, as Amos and others are always trying to implore us to understand our power with our dollars. We want to believe that we're poor and downtrodden and that our answer is more government assistance, more programs, more freebies, more handouts, more crumbs that fall from massa's table. When in reality, when you talk about spending so many trillions of dollars every year coming from one community, one group of people that is spending more than most nations, I don't know if we really even can allow ourselves to understand that. And I don't know if the number is so big that it no longer is comprehensible to us. But the point was that that is a show of your spending power, that this product is geared very personally to the black woman who spends so many trillions of dollars on her hair, right? And so since that shift now is coming from, you know, you're not going to give that to the Koreans so hard, Pantene says, hey, I want some of it. Give me some too, right? And so I posted that, and the point that I was making was this is an illustration. It shows, demonstratively, that you have a great amount of power and that people are vying for that power and that we can use that for our benefit, not just to get a conditioning wash, you know what I mean, but to get to actually make things happen. And so the answer to that, when I posted that, and as I tried to wrap up this really long story, was that the people, the women were saying, oh, well, you know, it's a business, we need stuff for our hair, and if it's a good product, that's great that Pantene put something out there for us. That's how this world works. It's just about money, and, you know, there's room for the little guy and the big guy and everything, and everything is everything, and that's great. I'm glad that they put out a product for me.
You know what I'm saying? I want to know how did you find this page? You know what I'm saying? I'd be like...
Right.
I'm like...
Or is it, I'm just trying to say what you were talking about the change in thinking. And when I'm faced with that, I wonder, like, when we talk about, well, we have to learn better and this and that, and I'm thinking like you used to say, oftentimes you would say, these people do know better.
Yeah.
They do know. Because if I just said what I just said to you, and then your answer to me is, well, that's great that they have that. I'm not saying whether that's great or not. That is so not the point. The point is to show us, you know, here, listen, look, this is something we do have power and money, because here they are, again, trying to, funnel our money, you know, instead of us wanting to do natural hair care, learning how to make our own products, or purchasing products from other people who are making natural hair products, you know, in the small cottage industry in our community. Instead of doing that, they want, you know, Pantene wants to get your money. And you're saying, well, that's a mighty fine idea, you know, because I could pick that up when I'm, you know, at the Walmart. And so it's really convenient.
All right. Yes, that sure is. It sure is convenient.
So I was saying all of that to say that I don't know that, you know, the change in thinking, I think it's being rejected. I don't think that some of us don't really want to think.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, I agree. I was saying about people finding our pages and tuning out to a lot of our propaganda, because they don't, those people primarily aren't our main audience for the podcast, but they are all over the page ready and waiting for a quick rebuttal to when you present something to demonstrate, you know, how we should, you know, how the appropriate response,
right,
to their action.
Right.
Like, I could go on as examples galore, but they're right on the button. Now, they don't take the time out, thank goodness, to come to these programs. But, you know, thank goodness we don't take a lot of calls. And I think that's one of the reasons why. We don't provide a lot of opportunity for debate. And I don't really want that. I'm not interested in arguing people and fighting with them like they try to lure us into on the wall. But we don't, you know, which we don't take debate.
Right.
Because we got work to do, and we know what we're doing. And we're trying to find people that understand this and not sit around and prove all the nuances of our points to people that aren't interested in them anyway.
Right.
So that'll be a waste of my energy and my resources engaging them in those fruitless, senseless battles.
Right.
So I move on to more, you know, beneficial work. And so they, you know, they have to go somewhere else, and that's what what we intend to do here. But you know, those people don't want to do it. They just give us bust our balls and give us a hard time.
Mm.
That's it. Yeah, I said it.
I didn't say nothing.
I know. I was like, oh my god, here he goes again, Mr. Scorpio.
Oh.
Yeah, let's get into the text for the night.
Okay.
Professor Aharon is I mean, he's really pointing something out that things that Professor Amos and few others, few people, see, you know these things, and we try to you know shine a bright light on these accomplished thinkers' work like this, so that you know it can drown out some of the garbage. At least all of, you know, as much as we can, that is so normalized in African American cultural common sense that it's really cultural insanity. But here he is. This section is called Inheriting Enemies. He says on page 50. He says, to the applause of many, a handful of blacks have been appointed to high level military, security, and foreign relations positions over the past few years. This, however, is also a very frightening development, because with all the accompanying media visibility, an inaccurate message is being sent to the world that black America has a controlling international voice in government. The truth is that we are still struggling with domestic issues like affirmative action, racial profiling, routine maximum prison sentences, corporate discrimination, and urban educational disparities. So we definitely have no say-so whatsoever in foreign affairs. The government doesn't even care what we think about U.S.-African policy. And so, you know, just you know, that highlighting that right there. We got all of these, you know, black first, you know, beginning, being heavily featured in the 40s. You know, remember Mary McLeod Bethune was in the cabinet of FDR.
Right.
Black people was like, oh yeah, and Ralph Bunche got to be ambassador to some country to the UN back in the 50s. People just, oh yeah, black man, we visible. Everybody in the world knows that the Negro is a peon, literal peon flunky. I don't care how nice and well tailored his suit is, and how many steaks he eats a week, and what private school he gets to send his servant children to. He's just a peon. But they're happy peons, well-paid peons.
Right.
And sad to say, our community at large is totally okay with that. Right. And they don't know, they just put themselves in the crosshairs of every conflict that global white supremacy is embroiled in throughout the world. And they're more than happy to put us in them crosshairs because they feel that the payoff is worth it.
Mm-hmm.
That's scary to me.
Right.
I'm frightened by, you know, being surrounded. Not, I'm not frightened, but I'm just saying I'm apprehensive. I'm uncomfortable.
Right, disturbed.
I'm disturbed about that. And that's why I would say intentionally, you know, I don't really feel like, you know, I really need to surround myself with a whole lot of people.
Right.
Because, you know, there's a lot of nuttiness going on. And they need to be careful to filter. Because this is, I mean, you know, you saw how people got all worked up behind Obama and, you know, these guys. And they want to send this message that we somebody or something. What the hell does that mean? That means you could when you get captured by the America's enemies overseas, they might pull your fingernails out too.
Right.
The point I'm making is black folk is willing to share in everything. Mostly the punishments, the wrath of other nations, you know, with the white man. And they don't resist.
I saw just today, Charles, a young man, a black man, posted about the, apparently somebody over there, you know, in the royal family has had a baby recently. And so he was saying, you know, you guys have forgotten about Trayvon and now you're worried about the royal family and their babies. While forgetting our own, not to mention the fact that, you know, we fought to be free from them a long time ago, didn't we? Wait a minute,
what the hell are you talking about?
Wait a minute.
See how he just got, see how his reasoning just got mixed right back up, that circular, he got thought right back in it again.
Right.
We can't be concerned about them because we fought them to be free. No, you didn't fight, no more.
What?
I mean, that was fighting. Black folks, our ancestors did fight the British. Some of us sided with the British, but the whole point is, at that time, black folks was trying to figure out who they was going to get freer from.
Let me tell you something. We haven't fought to be free from anybody in a really long time.
That's what I'm saying. That's what it is. At that time, black folks had more sense. Some of them were promised freedom for fighting the British, and others promised freedom for fighting the Americans. Either way, they was trying to get free.
Right.
Now, what is a black man trying to get? He ain't trying to get free no more.
Acceptance.
He's trying to get acceptance.
Assimilation.
Right.
Right.
And so he's still getting, you know, railroaded and after. But, you know, we're going to get into this later on in this chapter. This section is not a chapter. Let me get the next section. He says, the assigning of blacks to high-level appointments accomplished two psychological objectives. One, it placates blacks with the preserved sense of importance and progress. The perceived sense of importance and progress. Two adversaries of Euro-Americans begin to equally regard us as adversaries as well. Now, do you want somebody doing that? You know, like Muhammad Ali, or like when we over in other countries fighting, you want them to understand that I am a slave to these people. Let me go and you can hold them hostage.
Right.
I mean, it's really... You got black folks now, I'm staying with my troop because I'm an American with them. If you black and you can say that about the guys that you're serving with in the military, your mind is scrambled.
Right.
You're friggin' batty as a fruitcake, another fruitcake, and batty as something. We'll go with that. It's my sentence. Finish.
Right.
There it is. The second objective is the frightening part, because it cleverly ensures that we receive the wrath of people who are willing to violently object to U.S. foreign policies. In the process, we have become racial tokens of convenience in an international game of political and psychological chess. Right. Understand that you're just a piece of a chess piece of manipulation in this place. Now, you can try to finagle that into something for your benefit when I'm saying your benefit, we mean your second person plural. Your, you know. not individual, but for the collective. And too bad our community doesn't understand that kind of concept.
Right. It's too bad that you even have to explain that that whole concept is predicated on you.
Explain.
That everyone knows we're talking about, you know, not in an individualistic way. And many of us have become very, very offended by idea of considering someone other than themselves.
Yeah.
And even find it foolish.
Yeah. That ego-centeredness is virulent in the black.
And driven home. It's been driven home to great heights.
I personally think, you know, but I'm not going to get into that right now. I'm featuring Professor Aharon's work.
Mm-hmm.
I'm married. I'm commenting on that.
Okay.
Sorry. Thank you for giving me back.
Mm-hmm.
He says, further on, next paragraph, he said, to this end, an overly magnified symbol of black authority was presented to the world by the means of the lone black Supreme Court Justice, Clarence H. Thomas. It may have escaped notice to many, but it was not coincidental that after September 11th, Justice Clarence Thomas performed the televised swearing-in of Governor Tom Ridge as the Director of Homeland Security. Footage of this ceremony was broadcast worldwide, showing a black man swearing in a white man into a presidentially appointed office to defend against enemies who specialize in urban guerrilla warfare. Besides the ceremony mocking the powerlessness of black America, the real catch-22 is that Clarence Thomas has very little, if any, regard for black issues or Africa. Now, that's interesting. See, most black people look at that and they just say, oh, Clarence Thomas, he a Republican. See, they've broken the black ability to discern and analyze things into an extreme, factional, left wing, right wing. They can constantly divide and subdivide.
Right. Well, we're given the choices. These are the choices, and I've given them to you. And to, you know, it takes a certain amount of, you know, thinking outside of that to reject both choices.
Right.
You know, that too is an option. They don't tell you that. You must choose left or right. There is no neither.
Right. Because they see the what benefits black people, that the define what's beneficial to black people is different for them than it is for you and I. They see getting more crumbs or being more subservient and getting more better compensated for that subservience as being the best thing for black folks.
Right.
That's what they see as best. We see a different type of sovereignty, a totally different way of relating to European Americanness and its allies from that, and they say, you know, we're not interested in that.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, anyway. Next paragraph, he says, by no stretch, long sentence. He said, this is confirmed time and time again through his ultra-conservative political views, his court voting record, and his written briefs. By no stretch of the imagination does he, as Clarence Thomas, represent a black perspective on the Supreme Court. But viewers around the world do not know this. Neither did they see his tokenism or conservatism at the swearing-in ceremony. All they saw was what appeared to be a black man with authority.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we see, too. It's just that he was appointed by a Republican president. That's the only reason why they're not riding his job. If with the same ideas he got in his mind, all he had to do was be appointed by a Democratic president. And that was it. If Bill Clinton had done it, he'd have been the greatest thing. You know?
Right.
That's it. That's the only difference. They don't know that the Bush and Clinton are buddies, and George Bush is Bill Clinton's mentor. And that doesn't even matter because they're so stuck into that partisan affiliation, they can't even see what sense they could possibly make. But it's almost time for you to get an announcement, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is. We're going to be going into overtime on the show, and so you'll need to call in to hear the rest of the show. To those listening live on the browser and to our guests in the chat room, hello, greetings to you. The phone number is 323-580-5707 if you'd like to call in and contribute to the conversation or listen to the remainder of this particular podcast. Otherwise, you can hear it in the rebroadcast archive show in about half an hour. And if you're unable to join us now, we will see you at this same time next week, next Wednesday, and hopefully every Wednesday. From here on until further notice, we will be featuring various authors. I think that we're going to finish up with Ezra's book, and you can find the postings for that, the information about our book club meetings and podcasts on the Facebook community page, which can be found at facebook.com/AKBeyondTheBook. That is African Knowledge Beyond the Book Club. You can also search that and join us there. All right. So until next time, Shalom.
Shalom.
All right. Go ahead.
Okay. Now, I mean, that's, you know, that mental rut, that loop the greater black community is stuck on is, I'm saying, it will be the death and perpetual subservience of black America as it continues to gain, I would say, more payment. The more black people we see appearing to be successful in this system of subservience, it's reinforcing the idea that that's the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
This is the right angle, man. You need to go with this, and it's really just a game of craps that they're playing to, you know, either you slip on a banana peel and end up in the penitentiary, or you can be a good slave and you might make millions of dollars. And too sadly, most of our people are willing to take that chance.
Mm-hmm.
They're willing to take the chance with your future because they don't want to protect everybody's manhood, everybody's womanhood, and so we all can have a better life. They say, you know what, I'm striking out with a few low-down, dirty bastards, and we're going to see if we can get something from these people that's been whooping our asses for 200 years or 500, whatever. And, you know, it's going to be a lot of people going to perish in this thing, and a lot more on the other side, and screw the hell out of you, and you can pay me.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much what they're saying.
Right. Pay me off.
Pay me off, and they want you to pay me to buy my record, buy my book, pay me, you know, a lecture, you know, whatever, contribute to my re-election campaign, you know, pay me, you know, but that's how it is. But look at this next one. He said this also brings to an interesting observation to mind. If we view ourselves separate and apart from European Americans, a very significant distinction immediately stands out. Not only do we have our own unique identity, but just as importantly, we also do not have any real enemies of our own. Think about it. All of our so-called enemies were either delegated to us or inherited through our association with European Americans. Moreover, aside from Euro Americans, no other people, including Al-Qaeda or the Iraqis, have ever been directly adversarial to us, and we certainly have never been personally adversarial to anyone in history, including European Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that. The only people who've been, you know, closely, violently in relating to us, we are showing them all this love.
Mm-hmm.
See what I'm saying?
That's it.
But I'm waiting. But he says, as strange as it is, we have pledged our loyalty to the only people who have ever been our direct adversary and who, in addition, have a long and detailed history of war and known enemies scattered throughout the earth. Consequently, despite our innocence, we now pay the price of this odd association by living in an anxiety society, complete with a zany color-coded terrorist alert system where people believe duct tape can save them.
Mm.
If that ain't madness, who would is?
All right. We're out.
We're out.
I really don't like this new Blog Talk thing.
I know you're waiting for that sound.
Oh. There it is. Here we go. That was a great idea. I'm so glad that they thought to do that.
They are so smart.
I mean, it's beautiful. It's really beautiful.
It's all, yeah, it's
right in the middle of your conversation and everything. I love it.
Right. That's
all right, go ahead. Oh, wow.
You know what I mean? It's, we just can't put it together. We don't want, I mean, we can put it together. Like I said, we gotta understand. But we're so, like I said last week, we're so morally compromised.
Mm-hmm.
Our morality is trash. And that's why we are destroyed, because we don't want to be no any better than we are.
Right.
We see no point in trying to correct that for the better. We're just pursuing the same corrupt directive program with greater intensity and zeal. And that's what I see going on in our community. We're just getting better at it, more sophisticated at being a better slave.
Right.
We've taken it to operatic heights. We've made it like, I think we've gone into uncharted territory in being a servant. I think we shouldn't be trying to do that, but I think we've done such an excellent job at being white folks' footstool that, you know, we had become an impressive feat of subservience.
Right.
And so everybody looks upon it with awe and claps, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we say, oh, man, that was impressive. We got to keep doing. We got to do better. But as a throwback to what we were talking about earlier, about, you know, being caught up in his conflicts with other nations, he talks about this on page 52. He says, speaking of going free, our unique identity and innocence of having no enemies were recognized in 1979 when Iranian students violently attacked the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and held Americans as hostages for 444 days. Even though the Iranians had but utter contempt for America, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini unconditionally released all black hostages in an act of compassion. Realizing that we had our own unresolved issues with America, Iran did not consider us part of the controversy it had with the U.S. government. In the end, the establishment convinced us of a different reality, and Iran was delegated as an enemy of black folks. And that's true. You know, you see, I mean, I could talk to some guys in the military who were, you know, my age, you know, in their 40s, and we would talk about not wanting to enlist in the military, doing war, getting out before war began, not wanting to really get caught up in Mr. Charlie's conflict. And today, you see these young brothers, they're in their 20s or they're under 30 now, and they don't even give a darn. They don't give a damn if it's a war going on. They just say, oh, well, I'm going to go and join the military. It's a good job. I'm going to serve my country. What the hell? Your country.
Mm-hmm.
You ain't got no country. What the hell is wrong with you? Now they black folks around here talking about the N-word and all that kind of stuff. I mean, white folks is really brainwashing Negroes are just, you know, ooh, we say this because that's racist. And, you know, just total assimilation, identification. Like, I don't know who y'all are anymore. Like, I don't know y'all. Y'all ain't really black folks, really. I mean, what I thought, except in the worst ways, they still retain all of that.
Damn.
But all of the good things that we had about being black are gone. They're disappearing with amazing speed and precision.
You know, is this, are we in the,
bitter zone, yeah.
Okay. I was just checking. We haven't been in the bitter hour in such a long time.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know if we were back there now.
There you go. I'll tell you this right. Professor Iron lays it down. Like, what we've been saying the whole time. He said, no, and speaking of, you know, us not being in it, Mr. Charlie convincing us that the Iranians or any other people are our enemy too,
mm-hmm.
this has nothing to do with being pro or anti-Iranian. He said, our point is that our interest, that's black folk, that's you, Negro, that's saying you ain't no Negro now, whatever here a white man told you you is,
mm-hmm.
or his flunky Negro, as well as those of the world, would be better served if we use more discretion to determine who is and who is not our enemy. I repeat, he said, that Professor Iron is saying is that my point is that our interests, as well as those of the world, will be better off if we use more discretion to determine who is and who is not our enemy. We should protect our remaining innocence, I mean, what we got left, from being guilty by association. Come on, man. We should have that kind of sense a long time ago. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
We used to have it. Cause we all, you old, you know, me and you, somebody saying, man, we all remember when we used to think like that.
Right.
Certain kinds of places you didn't want to go or be around at a certain time because you felt that the guilt, you would gauge whether you're going to be around there by the weight of the guilt.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But others might think of you being there.
Right, because, you know, with what white man doing in the world, all his wickedness, it's only so much. I mean, we know some such as you got to have because you're captive in his country. So you can't abstain from all of it. But you try to minimize that association.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least the type of white people that you associate with. You ain't got to associate with all of them, but at least ones that understand and sympathize with your situation.
Mm-hmm.
That's called the discretion that the professor's talking about. We ain't using no discretion. Any person of non-black heritage and especially of European heritage, if they smile at us and offer us shiny things, we get in the car and get the daylights raped out of us to kingdom come.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm.
I wonder why that happened, and that was prejudice.
Yeah, how funny.
That's what he been doing. He been raping you since he seen you, running around all free. And he made these nice shiny handcuffs for you and told you to get in his, he'll take you on a trip around the block.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And we still in the car.
Yeah.
You know, but here we go. He says, we should protect our man innocence by being, you know, guilty by association with the same aggressive policies of which our ancestors were the greatest casualties, which I just said that. We have been the casualties of the same stuff he's doing. Why are you trying to hang out with him like that? You know, he said it makes no sense for us to continually walk the plank whenever European Americans decide it's time to go to war. They are definitely the deciders of war because we do not have ample political representation to outvote war proposals or shape foreign policy directions. We don't have that. So either you get it or you try to abstain from it. Or go somewhere else. We need to do that. We need to, you know, make some kind of way we can, you know, move around a little bit more freely. And so there is a ridiculous school of nationalistic propaganda circulating that people who oppose to war are anti-American. And the public has been finagled to believe that the rah-rah-rah spirit of war and nationalism is the only way to express condemnation of terrorism. As such, as much as free speech and the press are supposed to be hallmarks of America, expressions of opposition to the war have cost people their jobs and careers. If some public figures have bitten their tongues and to try not to say the wrong thing, and people in general are not willing to risk their political or entertainment careers by saying something that may derail their re-election or damage their CD or box office sales. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So basically, folks are sold out and compromise themselves to the point that they can't stand up for things that they believe in. Or they could do it, but they're not willing to do it because they have no support from their own community. There's no solidarity among black people to hold, to cover each other's ass. So basically, you out there on your own.
Right.
So you know your community ain't got your back. So if you say something, you better hope the white man got your back, because ain't no support coming from black people. So then they leave all black people in fear of what the European gonna do, because you know you ain't about nothing. You know, that's basically what that means. I mean, I know Professor Aron probably wouldn't agree to say it that way.
Right.
Articulation is kind of harsh and whatnot, but it's true. Because if your people, that's why white people say all kind of crazy things on TV, call folks niggas, oh yeah, I said it, which, you know, we know what nigga mean black, but we know they have contempt for the word black too, and for black folk.
Mm-hmm.
White people support them right to do that too, to have contempt for you, no matter what word they decide to use to express that contempt. And they respect each other's right to do so, and they support it. And black folk, no, black people don't do anything to that regard. We talking about how crazy and how he got himself killed and he got his career, he a stupid fool and whatnot. And so you wonder why ain't nobody looking out for you, really? You know?
Mm-hmm.
Why? You know, because it's cultural. It's a cultural issue. It's a cultural weakness that we have. And
that's correct.
Right. How many minutes we got?
About 3.5, 4.
Okay. Okay, I can wrap this up in that minute.
Okay.
Okay, well, I'm just going to hear right here. He said, while it is a main to show, skip all that. Let's just get down to meat potatoes.
Okay.
We have a bad habit, a bad trait of our slave circuit life. We carried it, you know, over into the present. He said, we entered every war since the Revolutionary War assuming that we would be rewarded at the end instead of placing the onus on America to earn our loyalty. I'm not going to read the last couple sentences, 2 or 3 sentences, but the point, that's the meat and potatoes right there. That's what we was doing on the plantation. We still on the plantation is our point. The point is we still slaves, we still brainwashed, still don't know how to function as a people with good sense. So therefore, we act in a powerless, subservient way, which is why we are the best servants in the world. We're the best paid servants and the most, right. We got it going on in terms of being paid. We're doing better than materialism than some free people.
Mm-hmm.
People have their dignity, and we do not have it. And there you go. And we won't get it until we do. And that's a wrap.
That's it.
Go. Drop the mic. You heard it. Oh, you hate it.
Something is wrong with me.
Yeah. I live here in America. And something ought to be wrong with me.
Well, now, touche. Point well taken, and I agree completely. All right, so are you about, what is the name of this book, which I don't know if you shared that at the beginning?
The book is called Pawn Sovereignty, subtitled Sharpened Black Perspectives on Americanization, Africa, War, and Reparations, written by Professor Ezra Aharon. And you can get it, anywhere where books are sold, and it's nationally, internationally distributed.
And you can also check this network. You spoke with him on African Conversations, I believe it was 2 times, right?
Once, but he's coming on African Conversations again. He'll be joining us here on African Now. I'll never discuss this book, probably next week.
Oh, wow. Next week? Okay.
Early next week. We're going to talk tomorrow, actually.
Okay. All right, so he might be here. That would be great. He's a dynamite speaker. If you think that this book is amazing, to hear him speak about it is even more dynamic because he's very passionate about the things that he says. And that would be something to miss. So try to, stay close to the page, and Charles will post things. As he schedules them, so that you can come out and hear the podcast with Israel. All right, well, that's it, I guess.
That's it.
All right, holla.
Right, shalom, peace out.
See you next time, peace.